and welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis. With us today, Dr. Marcy Dries. She is the Chief Infection Prevention Officer for Christiana Care, and we're going to talk about flu today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Flu is top of mind in the Delaware Valley right now because, of course, back in 1918, we were a chief spreader of the disease. And there's a big museum exhibition right now at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. Spit spreads death. So a lot of us are thinking about influenza. But should we always be thinking about flu?
Absolutely. I think every year is a potential for a bad flu season. You know, 1918 was a particularly bad pandemic flu when a new strain really spread across the globe that people had very little immunity to. We actually have had three pandemics in the 20th century, and we've had one already in the 21st century, the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. But every year can be a potentially severe flu season.
Swine flu was one of them. Am I right there?
Yeah, so swine flu is kind of a little bit of a misnomer, but that's what the 2009 pandemic was initially called. It ended up being a virus that had some swine flu components, but also some avian and human components. But basically, it was a brand new virus, and that's why it spread so rapidly.
Well, you said avian just now. We do tend to name our flus, don't we?
Yeah. So, I mean, every species has flu viruses that tend to prefer that species. So the ones we worry about the most, obviously, are human strains of flu, but birds are very susceptible to flu, so avian flu. Swine are particularly susceptible to flu, and they can be problematic because they can get not only their own strains of swine flu, but they can also get avian strains and human strains. So they end up being kind of a mixing pot of different strains of flu that can co-circulate in the same animal, and that is a prime situation for new strains of flu to emerge, and that's what we're all worried about.
Let's start with the basic information, though. What exactly is flu?
Yeah, so influenza is a respiratory virus. So we have, a lot of people refer to something called the stomach flu, and that's not what we're talking about today. So that is, we're talking about influenza. It is primarily a respiratory disease. There are two major categories of flu that affect humans, influenza A and influenza B. And frequently we'll see multiple strains of each in any given season. The one we worry about the most is influenza A, because, you know, both strains will what they call drift a little bit year to year, and that's why we need a new flu vaccine every year, because the strains that circulate change a little bit year to year. But only influenza A does what we call antigenic shift, and that's when you get this new strain of virus emerge because of the, you know, combinations of other strains like we talked about, and then you end up having a virus where the majority of the population has very little existing immunity to it. And again, that's what happened in 2009 with the pandemic.
You know, when you mentioned stomach flu, and I just did the air quotes there,
yeah.
That's not really a flu, is it?
No, and I'm not exactly even sure how it got that name. I think it's another type of virus. Typically, it's norovirus, which is also very easily transmitted person to person.
Cruise ship virus.
Exactly. Causes a totally different syndrome. You can sometimes get some stomach symptoms with influenza, but it is primarily a respiratory disease.
Well, let's go into then. How do you distinguish that something is influenza? You know, starve a cold, feed a fever, whatever,
right,
all
right,
that.
Right.
How do you know that it's a flu versus some other type of a respiratory infection?
Yeah, well, you don't always know without testing, and you don't always need to be tested. But classically, you know, the difference between a cold, you know, and the problem is a lot of these viruses circulate at the same time. So we're kind of coming into cold and flu season. So there's a lot of stuff out there already circulating. A cold, you'll typically will build up to its maximum severity over a couple of days. You know, the first day you're sneezing a little bit more than usual, and then the next day you might be more congested, and then by day three you have a cough, and then it, you know, wanes over time as well. The flu, I always say, it feels like, you know, you go from feeling pretty normal to feeling like you were run over by a truck. Like rapid onset of just feeling miserable, achy, headache, cough, often a fever. You don't tend to have much fever with a cold, although you can have a low-grade fever. So some of it is severity, and a lot of the differentiation is just how quickly the onset is. That said, you know, not everybody reads the textbook. So you can have mild cases of flu that you wouldn't know unless you happen to be tested. And some people can even be asymptomatic with flu and not have any symptoms at all, but they can still spread it to others.
Speaking of spreading, how do we spread flu?
So again, a respiratory virus, so it lives in the upper airways and the lower airways. So anything that we do that we, you know, so we always think about coughing and sneezing, obviously, is a very efficient way of spreading. All that virus is loaded up in your saliva, and it spreads all over. And obviously, that gets on our hands. It gets on the table. It gets on a tissue. It gets on, you know, whatever you use to cover your cough. And if that, if you then go and touch a doorknob, a telephone, a table, you leave your tissues somewhere, all that, those surfaces all get contaminated too. So you don't actually have to be directly affected by somebody sneezing on you to get the flu. You can touch something that someone with flu touched. And even talking, like believe it or not, we exhale small droplets when we talk, not even visible necessarily, and that can certainly spread as well.
When are we infectious with influenza? Is it the entire time we have symptoms, or does it start before and linger after?
Unfortunately, one of the issues that makes flu even more difficult to manage is that you actually are contagious before you know that you're sick. So they estimate about 24 hours before that episode where you feel like you've been run over by a bus, you actually are contagious then. So you don't know. You know, so it becomes impossible to tell people, well, just don't come to work when you're sick. And prevent flares, and which is still very important, mind you, but that's not going to prevent all spread.
And of course, you could come to work feeling, oh, okay, and in the day, feeling like you want to just crawl somewhere and die.
Yep. And at that point, you certainly should. Once you know you have symptoms, you should go home. And that's why vaccination is so important. If we can prevent you from getting sick in the first place, then you never have that opportunity to spread.
Speaking of spreading, cough into your elbow, obviously, they say, but if obviously some of it is getting away from you, and if we're just talking and spreading germs right now, what are some of those simple things that somebody can do to protect others, and what can we do as we're just walking around not knowing that we're sitting next to a time bomb in the next cubicle?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, you're never going to mitigate all risk. Certainly, people who are sick should always be covering their cough, either with a tissue or, like you said, coughing into your elbow rather than into your hands. If you do cough into your hands, go ahead and wash them right away. All of us should be washing our hands frequently because, again, you know, we touch surfaces all over. If you're in any public place, you're being exposed to multiple viruses all the time. So washing your hands frequently, you know, we all touch our you know, and what happens when you touch with your hands, it doesn't infect you through your hands, obviously. What happens then is you touch your eyes or your nose or your mouth, which we all do dozens and dozens of times every day. So trying to be more conscious about, you know, not touching your face quite so much unless you've been washing your hands frequently.
Speaking of washing your hands, is soap sufficient? Should we be using any of these wipes that are sold to us? And what about these antibacterial wipes that are so heavily promoted? It's hard to find, actually, anything that doesn't have that in there.
Yeah, and that actually, so soap and water is fine, and you don't need an antimicrobial soap. We actually have, there's been some research that shows that since we've been adding all these antibacterial agents to all our soaps and all our products, really, those get out into the environment, and bacteria, which is not what we're talking about today, but bacteria then become resistant to those. And they may become resistant not only to that particular soap, but that also gives them some ability to evade antibiotics as well. So we actually don't recommend the antimicrobial soaps in general. Just good old soap and water, hand washing is fine. And of course, the alcohol hand gels are perfectly fine as well. Those will kill any influenza virus and most everything else as well. And there really is not much opportunity for any of these viruses to become resistant to alcohol.
If we get the flu, and what should we do if we do have it? We've gone home, we're protecting our coworkers and our friends, we've gone home, we pulled the covers over our heads. What should we be doing? What are the treatments that are available for someone?
So a lot of it is symptomatic treatment. So you can take, you know, a fever-reducing medication like acetaminophen, keep making sure you're keeping up with your fluids, getting plenty of rest. For most people who are otherwise healthy, that you may just have to ride it out, and you'll be fine. The people that might need to at least call their physician and discuss whether they want a specific antiviral treatment would be people that are a higher risk risk for getting complications of flu. So pregnant women, the very young and very old, which typically is defined as less than 5 and greater than 65. People, not that 65 is very old, but that's just those extremes. And people who have other underlying conditions that make them maybe they're immunosuppressed or they have chronic lung disease or, you know, something that makes them more likely, if they do get the flu, to end up in the hospital or become very ill.
What makes flu so deadly? You know, giving back to those names, Spanish flu, for instance, the 1918 flu that just took out thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, I mean, millions.
I mean,
the 1918 flu killed more people than World War I did. So that was a particularly bad example in that you had a very virulent strain of flu and you had a population that had very little immunity to it. When people die from flu, sometimes they die directly from flu. So it can cause pneumonia, a viral pneumonia that can make people very sick, unable to breathe. I mean, remember in 1918, we also didn't have antibiotics. We didn't have ventilators. There have been a lot of changes in medical care since that time. But still, it was a very severe strain. Then the 2009 H1N1 was luckily, it was a strain that spread very easily, but it was not as virulent, meaning it did not cause individuals to be as sick as it could have been, you know, had given the population's lack of immunity, it would have been really devastating had it been a more virulent strain. That said, you know, many people did indeed die from flu in 2009. So any strain really can cause death in susceptible people.
And it's through pneumonia?
So sometimes, yeah, usually it's pneumonia. And again, it can be a primary pneumonia or it can be a secondary bacterial infection. So people get flu. Sometimes they can get a staph pneumonia or a strep pneumonia at the same time. Sometimes they're actually getting better from flu and then they get sick again. And then that's a bacterial pneumonia that causes them to be very sick and die.
And so calling a doctor, usually it's if you are more likely to have complications or you're already having health issues. Otherwise, we write it out?
Well, again, for many times you can. It's not wrong to request antiviral medication. But, you know, most of the data has shown that in otherwise healthy people, it might shorten. You're going to be sick for, you know, 3 to 5 days regardless. Taking antiviral medication might shorten that by a day. So it's not like, you know, oh, as long as I get my, you know, Tamiflu, I'm going to feel better tomorrow. That's not really how it works. So it's based on what is your risk. But then certainly if you're having severe symptoms, you're having difficulty breathing, you're confused, you can't keep anything down. I mean, regardless of what your underlying health is, you should be seeking medical care.
And you said there was fever involved?
It can be
this.
Fever. You don't have to have fever with flu, but frequently the fever will be involved.
Okay. You just mentioned Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm.
I should say
oseltamivir is the generic.
The generic,
yeah. Yes.
Never having known that I was sick in time to even try that, are there any medicines that actually do work against the flu once you have been infected?
Yeah, so oseltamivir is one. There are a couple other antivirals that are specifically active against flu. Ideally, you want to start them within the first 2 days of illness because they'll be less effective the longer you wait. If you're sick enough to be in the hospital, you'll probably be treated regardless of how long you've been sick, just because we feel that there's benefit there. But again, like the longer you wait, you know, again, it depends on your, you know, what your underlying health conditions are, how sick you are, and how early you present for care.
Hey, if you're just joining us, this is Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from ChristianaCare, we have its Chief Infection Prevention Officer, Dr. Marcy Drees. And we are talking, obviously, about influenza today. And for more information about flu, go to the government. Go to cdc.gov/flu. That's cdc.gov/flu. You're a chief prevention officer, and I do want to hear more about that because there are far more awful things out there besides influenza, but we're talking about prevention. We're not talking about cure. The best thing to do is just try to prevent flu.
Well, yes. I mean, for any disease, prevention is always better than trying to cure. But and we do have, you know, we have a number of tools in the toolbox. So some of what we've already talked about, you know, the healthier you can maintain yourself in in general. Like if you have diabetes, you're keeping your diabetes in good control, having a good diet, exercise, getting enough sleep, all those things will improve your resilience to any sort of a virus. But obviously the main tool in our toolbox is the influenza vaccine. And we do recommend that everybody over the age of 6 months be vaccinated against the flu. And really, you know, as soon as possible at this point, because we are starting to see flu kind of starting to circulate in the community.
Now, you mentioned the flu season before the show began. You said that the flu season actually has been extended. There is a season for flu?
Yeah. In the Northern Hemisphere, it tends to circulate when we in slightly colder temperatures. And part of that is just we're indoors more. We are around each other. We're more in enclosed spaces, so it's much easier to transmit flu. In the Southern Hemisphere, it occurs in the what we would call our summer months, June, July, August. In the tropics, it actually circulates year-round. So it varies, but we typically think of flu season as October through March in the Northern Hemisphere.
So you get the vaccine before the season begins, or do you get it after it's come through? You mentioned different strains. Which flu shot is usually given?
Right. So you try to get it before we start to see much flu in the community, just so that it can take up to 2 weeks for the vaccine to really take effect and make you protected. So we don't want to wait until we're in the midst of flu season to get it. That said, if you haven't had the opportunity to get it and we're seeing a lot of flu, it's never too late. Like, we continue to vaccinate people up through April if they haven't already gotten it. But ideally, you want to shoot for kind of late September, October, and now, you know, even into November, trying to get that flu shot accomplished.
What actually is in a flu shot? How does it actually work?
So there are a couple different types of flu shots, but all of them have either 3 or 4 strains of flu. We talked earlier about influenza A and influenza B. For the last several decades, there have been 2 strains of influenza A that have predominated, and they kind of take turns which one will be more common in a given season. But one is H1N1, and this is the same virus that emerged in 2009 with the swine flu pandemic. And the other one is called H3N2. And those numbers and letters just mean, you know, what are the different types of hemagglutinin and neuraminidase that are found on the surface of the flu virus, and that's just how scientists classify them. And then the other strain of other type of flu that circulates is influenza B. And there typically are 2 different strains of influenza B that can co-circulate in a season. So most of the flu vaccines that are available now are what they call quadrivalent, quad meaning 4. So they have 1 of the influenza A strain, or 2 of the influenza A strains and 2 of the influenza B strains. Now, when they decide what's going to go into a given season, the WHO and CDC and others meet starting back in February, trying to figure out and predict which strains are going to be circulating in the Northern Hemisphere in October. So a little bit of it is a guessing game. They do look to see what's been circulating in the Southern Hemisphere and in the tropics and try to, you know, match what they think is going to continue on. And usually it ends up being a good match. Occasionally the virus shifts or changes and it ends up not being a good match. But it takes a significant amount of time to create the flu vaccine and mass produce it. So it is about a 6-month lag between choosing the strains and having the vaccine available.
Is the length of the flu season and the rapid changing of strains, is it because we're a global, not economy, but we travel globally? Because that contributed greatly to 1918's debacle.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that certainly facilitates its spread, and that not just of flu, but of everything else. It's, you know, you can be on the other side of the world in 12 hours, which certainly was not the case, you know, 50, 60 years ago. So I think it just puts us more at risk for any travel-related disease that's transmissible person to person.
Of course, we're thinking about mumps and measles that we're seeing now.
Yeah.
And it's, a tourist came and visited this amusement park, or this airport had a case reported, et cetera. So what kind of immunity do we get from our flu shot? Is it a guarantee we won't get it? And how long does the protection last?
It's not a guarantee, unfortunately. And we do have, you know, compared to other vaccines like the measles, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, where we get 95, 97% efficacy, which is lifelong. Unfortunately, our flu vaccines don't work that well. On any given year, we average about 60% effective, which is still much better than 0% protection, right? So 60 is better than zero. It still is not where we would like to be. And there certainly is ongoing research to develop a new, more effective, and even universal flu vaccine that might protect us for multiple years and get rid of this idea of having to get your flu shot every year. That said, you know, we expect, you know, any flu strain that you've been exposed to in the past, whether it was because you were sick or because you were vaccinated, you probably retain some immunity to that over time. But for any given year, we expect the flu vaccine to last about 6 months. But it's going to be variable person to person. We know that not everybody responds to the flu vaccine as well. People who are over the age of 65 simply don't respond to it as well. And that's due to what we call immune senescence. So your immune system kind of gets weaker over time. It is not going to respond to any vaccine as well as it did when you were younger. So there are some vaccines that are specifically formulated to overcome that. There's a high-dose vaccine that's specifically targeted for people 65 and older. There's another, what's called an adjuvanted vaccine, that's also targeted toward that age group, that give a better immune boost to that population.
Now, I know you cannot get the flu from a flu shot.
Right.
But now, are there any people who should not get a flu shot?
So there's actually very few who cannot get a flu shot. So there are, again, a couple different types of flu shots. There's one flu shot that's the intranasal shot, which is actually a live virus. It's actually pretty ingenious. This virus has been modified so that it lives in the cooler temperatures of the nose, but it's not able to survive in the warmer temperatures of the lung. So when you get that nasal vaccine, it actually kind of replicates in your nose, gives you that good immune boost that you want from the vaccine, but it's not able to actually go down into your lungs and cause clinical flu disease. But every other vaccine is what's called a killed vaccine. So it's not even the entire viral particle that's in there. It's a component that generates that immune response. So because of that, the virus or the flu vaccine is not, it's just biologically not capable of causing flu. I think, you know, I still have lots of patients who say, well, the last time I got a flu vaccine, I got the flu. Well, sometimes that can be because you were already exposed to flu. And like I said, it takes 2 weeks for this vaccine to kick in. So it seems like, oh, I got the flu vaccine and then I got the flu the next week. Well, you actually were exposed, you know, the week before. So it can't prevent that from happening. And the other thing is that a lot of these viruses, again, like I said, there's lots of other respiratory viruses, some of which really make, cause colds, but some can cause flu-like illness that is completely unrelated to the flu vaccine. So I think a lot of it is coincidence, because it's just biologically not possible to get the flu from the vaccine.
And of course, that's the person who in the next year will say, I don't want a flu shot. But now it's important for us because of something that you mentioned coming in, herd immunity.
Yeah, so I think it's really important. You know, the flu vaccine has multiple effects. So it will protect you at least 60% of the time against the flu. But even if you get the flu, it's been shown to prevent you from getting sick enough to be in the hospital. So we know that it prevents hospitalizations. There's even some research that says if you have heart disease, even if it's well-controlled heart disease, you are at risk of having a heart attack. You're at increased risk of having a heart attack 6 weeks after having influenza illness. Okay, so we don't even, you know, that's relatively new that we even understand kind of it, you know, flu just does a toll on the body and it makes everything else worse. So cardiovascular disease makes things worse. I forgot the second part of your question.
I've forgotten it too. Oh, herd.
Oh, yes, the herd immunity.
Yeah,
so,
herd immunity.
So you're protecting yourself, and again, not only from getting flu, but even if you get flu from other things as well, like being hospitalized, but then you're also protecting everyone around you. So like I said, the people who are 65 and older are the least likely to get a good immune response to the vaccine, but they are the most likely to actually be vaccinated, which is good because they are at increased risk of complications. So you're not only protecting yourself, you're protecting anyone around you who either may not respond as well to the vaccine, you know, or may not be vaccinated for whatever reason.
Obviously, now, Christiana Kerr, I know, did a big campaign. Beasley was involved with that, actually. You inoculated, you vaccinated like 8,000 people in one day alone with the Hit Me With Your Flu Shot campaign.
Yeah. So we, we're very proud of that campaign. We've been really focusing on improving our healthcare worker vaccination rates since the 2011-2012 season. And before that, it's not that we didn't do anything for flu. We kind of did what most healthcare associations do. We offered it for free. We educated, you know, we had clinics, or, you know, flu vaccine in the cafeteria, stuff like that. But we didn't, and we were stuck at about 65% vaccination rate. And part of that is we didn't know who else, like if one of our healthcare workers went to their primary doctor or to CVS or whatever and got vaccinated there, we wouldn't know. So I think our actual vaccination rate was higher than that, but as far as we knew, it was 65%. So after the H1N1 pandemic in 2009, we really made a concerted effort to get 100% participation into our flu vaccine campaign. So we developed a tracking system that was all electronic so that even if they didn't, if our healthcare workers didn't get it from us, they had to tell us that they got it somewhere else, or that they had a medical contraindication. And we did allow them to decline. But we put a lot of, we required people who weren't vaccinated to mask throughout the entire flu season. And we put a lot of accountability back to the healthcare workers and to the managers. So every week the managers would get a report saying, these are your employees who are vaccinated, these are who were not vaccinated, and these are the people that haven't completed the process yet. And having that accountability around it got, you know, over the next couple of years, got our vaccination rate to over 90%. And then the last couple of years, or this year and last year, we did, instead of doing it over 2 to 3 weeks, we decided to do it in one day. Part of that was to function as a drill. So if there ever were a case where we had to mass vaccinate our staff or to even like administer prophylactic antibiotics or something that we had to do very quickly, you know, we would have no idea how to do that until we did these drills. And so that was kind of a side benefit of doing this way. And plus, we were able to make it into kind of a fun event. You know, the radio station was there. You know, we had lots of other mascots and pet therapy dogs and just lots of activities surrounding the event. So it was something that people wanted to do because it was fun, not just something that they had to do.
You know, we didn't scare anybody with numbers. You actually had provided me with this, and that almost 36,000 and 61,000 Americans, somewhere in there, mm-hmm. died from the flu last year. So think about all that lost productivity.
Absolutely.
The lost family time, the lost time on the job. It's an economic crisis, really, too.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons that people always frequently state for not getting the flu vaccine is like, well, I never get the flu. And again, you know, they may have and not realized it was the flu because they didn't have the classic symptoms. And I'm like, well, even if you get the flu, yeah, the likelihood is you're not going to die. You're not going to be in the hospital, but you're going to feel like crap for at least a week. You're probably going to miss work. You know, you're going to run the risk of spreading it to your family or to other loved ones. So why take that chance when you have, you know, it's a pretty simple way to avoid it. You know, vaccines, I think, are, you know, vaccines in general are a victim of their own success, right? So, you know, back before I was born, you know, when people saw polio epidemics coming every late summer into fall, and they would see kids die from polio or become paralyzed from polio, you know, as soon as those vaccines were available, people were lining up around the block to get vaccinated because they saw the effects every year of what this disease could do. And now, even with the resurgence in measles, you know, most people have never seen a case of measles, and they don't realize, you know, it's a lot more than a bad case of chickenpox. Kids die from measles or become permanently, have permanent neurologic disorders. And even flu being, by far the most common vaccine preventable disease, you know, something like 25 or 26 people in Delaware died last year, more than that died the year before. Still a relatively small number. So most individuals have never known anybody to die from influenza, but it does happen. We've already had 2 pediatric deaths in the country, not in Delaware, but this year so far. So, and that certainly is always tragic.
So ask your doctor, check in at your drugstore, ask at work to see if they provide flu shots.
Yeah, there's never been more availability of different types of flu shots, really for anything that you want. You know, there are very few contraindications to a flu shot. Certainly if you've had an allergy to a flu shot in the past, then you should not be vaccinated. But other than that, there's really very few reasons why you shouldn't get it.
And, of course, find more information about influenza, cdc.gov/flu. That is our own government's website, cdc.gov/flu. And my guest today came from ChristianaCare, and we didn't even get a chance to talk about what you do as Chief Infection Prevention Officer for ChristianaCare, Dr. Marcy Dries. Thank you for coming in today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Get a flu shot. I hope you take that away from
Absolutely.
The show today. Take that flu shot. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.